Hello, Jeff.
Oh, well, thank you so much for speaking with me for this issue. I'm very excited to include Fernando Pessoa in our exploration of the transformative power of poetry because Pessoa had an enormously transformative effect on my life. And you and I worked together on this publication. It's Fernando Pessoa Poetry Minimal Anthology. We'll be talking about that today. My first introduction to Pessoa was through the Book of Disquiet, which I would describe as a collection of fragments, which are essentially prose poems. And there was something about that book. I first encountered it many years ago, but reacquainted myself with it more recently, 10 or 15 years ago. And the spirit that I feel behind those poems, this kind of deeply inwardly reflective power that Pessoa brings to that book, which I also feel in a great deal of his poetry, is what really captured me. And what it made me, I would say the transformative effect that Pessoa's writing had on me was that it made me realize that the medium of writing can be such a powerful tool for deep introspection. And that inspired me to want to write more, to want to explore more different kinds of writing. And we'll get into some of Pessoa's work. But I wanted to know a little bit from you to start out. How did you first get introduced to Pessoa, and what has been his impact on your life?
Where do I begin? Probably back in 2017, I was presenting a paper at a conference in Porto, and there at lunch with all the other conference presenters and professors, I happened to be sitting down at a table with Jerónimo Pizarro, and I know you know him. He's a professor of Portuguese literature in at the University of the Andes in Colombia. He's also the Pessoa's collection director at Tinta da China, Lisbon publisher, and I have published some five books under his editorship there, and he's, of course, the world famous Pessoa scholar, and he also edited our collection, Poetry Minimal Anthology. And we fell into conversation, quite easy to do. I was born in Mexico, so I'm of Mexican heritage, so he's Colombian. He's a modernist, especially in Pessoa. And I told him that I read in Portuguese. And of course, I always had Pessoa as a major modernist on my horizon. I had him on my radar to read as a modernist scholar myself, but I had never yet read him. And so it was quite fortuitous that here I am meeting the world famous scholar Pessoa. And we bonded and became fast friends. And the next day or the day after, he took me to some bookstalls, used bookstalls there in Porto, where he helped me select some books by Pessoa to bring back with me to Beirut, where I was teaching at the American University of Beirut. So I brought back about five or six books, thinking, this is just something that I must get to, and here's a perfect opportunity. Little did I know that I would very quickly fall in love with Pessoa, as you did. In fact, I think I began reading the Book of Disquiet, and I fell so in love with Pessoa that I ended up teaching prematurely, to be sure, passages from the Book of Disquiet in my modernism class the very following semester. And then the very following summer, I actually spent a month in Portugal living in Estoril on the sea and in Lisbon, where I again met up with Geronimo. And then within 1 year's time, I published my first scholarly article on Pessoa, and I was just hooked and launched. I was hooked, and I thought I really want to continue my studies of Pessoa, continue scholarship on Pessoa. I met a number of the Pessoa scholars there in Lisbon, and it was a sort of tribe thing, and I was hooked. But I had never dreamed of translating Pessoa until one night, years later. Did I say that we had met in 2017? Let me push that back to 2013.
Okay.
So the next time, well, one night in December 2020, Geronimo had invited a number of us scholars to join him in Porto to do some archival work. And so there are about half a dozen of us one night in an apartment that we were sharing after having spent the day scanning Pessoa archives from a private archive held in Santo Tirso, just outside of Porto. And Geronimo had, we were sitting on the couch there in the apartment, and he said, "I've just published a poetry anthology and a prose anthology." I forget whether I mentioned just out of the blue, "I'd love to translate," or I think he is the one who said, "Why don't you translate?" I think it was he. And I looked at him and I said, "Translate?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "But I don't translate." He said, "Try." And I was a bit flabbergasted, not to mention flattered. And I said, "All right, I'll try, but I think I would like to begin trying with the prose anthology rather than the poetry anthology, because what did I know about translating poetry, right?" And he said, "Well, actually, the prose anthology, it's either not out yet or I don't have a copy, but I do have a copy of the poetry anthology." And he handed it to me, and I took a look at it, and I thought, well, I guess I'll give it a try, as he suggested. And right then and there, I sat myself down at a table, the kitchen table there in the apartment in Porto, late one night, surrounded by, half a dozen Pessoa scholars and friends, cleaning up the day's scans, and there's pizza and beer everywhere. And I sat down, and lo and behold, once again I was hooked. I knew of no other way to translate rhymed and metered poetry except in rhymed and metered form, which of course was naive of me, because most translations of rhymed and metered poetry are done without rhyme and meter. But I, in my naivete, thought, "Oh, but of course you must translate with rhyme and meter." And I managed to translate a quatrain. I think it was what, A-B-A-B, rhyme scheme, and it was iambic pentameter, right? Verses. And I enjoyed it so much. And I thought, gee, I wonder if this is any good. And I showed it to Geronimo. And he said, "What have you been doing all your life? You've got the knack for it." And so it was off to the races. I never looked back. And it's been what now, 6 years? And five books later, and I'm working on my sixth book now. So I've translated poetry, minimal anthology, Message, a book of poems, prose minimal anthology, Love Letters, which just came out last week, or maybe this week. I think it should be in the bookstores in Portugal this week. And I also translated The Anarchist Banker, which should be coming out later this year. And right now I'm working on Faust, which is a verse drama of metaphysical vertigo. Pessoa's take on the Faust legend, of course.
I do want to ask you about the thing about your translation of poetry, which you just mentioned. Most often when poetry is translated, the rhyme and meter is lost, and the poems are translated in something more like free verse. And what that means is it's easier to translate because you're not constrained by the meter and rhyme. And I would imagine that trying to maintain the rhyming scheme while also maintaining the meaning of the poem must pose quite a challenge. And I would love you to just say a little bit about that challenge that you obviously have grappled with quite successfully with your book.
Sure. Before I answer, though, let me state from the outset, let me challenge you on what you said, that it's easier to translate rhymed and metered poetry into free verse. I too thought that. I also thought that, and for the longest time, I plumed myself on my ability to do the difficult thing to translate rhymed and metered poetry into rhymed and metered translation poetry. Until I had a conversation with a Pessoa colleague who maybe 3 or maybe 4 years ago published his own translation of poetry by the great 19th century Portuguese symbolist poet Camilo Peçanha. And we had a conversation. In fact, we had a conversation, I believe, about 3 days after you and I had a con that conversation at that cafe in Porto, because that's when I first met him. I was still of the opinion that, this is not only the right way, but also the very difficult way. And if other translators don't do it this way, it's because they find it too difficult. Now, he translated a book of poems as I said, Camilo Pessoa, also rhymed and metered poetry, but he translated it without rhyme and meter. And he told me that, he has his own theory. And he's more attuned to what he called the music of ideas rather than these specific rhythmic elements of rhyme and meter. And I understood his idea. Yes, I understood. And it wasn't until I sat down and read his actual translation a couple of years later and discovered what an amazing job he had done translating these rhymed and metered poems by Pessoa into, let's say, free verse. That I realized, what I really always knew all along, and that is that there's no one right way to translate poetry, or for that matter, rhymed and metered poetry, you can call it a calculus of costs and benefits, and everybody measures that calculus differently. Or you may phrase it this way. The translator always starts with an interpretation of the book he is translating, and if that interpretation leads him to adopt a strategy of free verse translation, God bless him. And if that interpretation leads him, as it led me, to adopt a strategy of rhymed and metered poetry or translation, then so be it. We're not drawing up equivalents. We're not creating equivalents for the original in translation. That's called it's called the equivalency theory of poetry translation, or of translation in general. The notion that the translator is able to find equivalents for the original text. That's kind of a naive theory, at least for literature folks like myself. There's a major theorist by the name of Lawrence Venuti who lays out this critique in a number of books. The alternative theory is the hermeneutic theory of translation. And that's a belief that every translation varies the source text in form, effect, and meaning. So I see myself and really all translations as recreations of the original. recreations that are always based implicitly or explicitly on an interpretation. I just happened to find much meaning in these formal rhythmic aspects of the original poems. I found that in translating Pessoa's rhymed and metered poetry, his use of rhyme and meter, the rhymed and meter did much of the load-bearing work. It conveyed much of the meaning, and I spell out how these rhythmic elements convey meaning in my translator's preface to Poetry Minimal Anthology.
That's fascinating, and your what you describe right there, very much your theory of translation, as far as I know, is very parallel to Pessoa's own theory of translation, because of course he did a lot of translating, and he was very much a proponent of the fact that you're always giving a variation of the poem, and that brings up interesting questions, which is this idea of the music of ideas in the poem. I think that's what you said. That's the phrase you used. It's translating a poem raises an interesting question about, well, what is the poem? Because the meter, the rhyme, the layout on the page, and the meaning all contribute to the poetry of the poem. And as you said, there's some calculus involved because you can't maintain it all in a different language. So you have to decide how you weight the various elements that make up the poem. And I think it's a beautiful dance. And I'm far from being an expert, but I love your translations in Minimal Anthology. I think they're fantastic. And I also love about this book that it includes images of the original poems, sometimes on typewritten pages, sometimes on handwritten scrawls on little scraps of paper, but you can really see, and sometimes they were written in English, so no translation required. Other times they're not, they're in Portuguese and therefore translation required, but you can really see what you're working with. So yeah, I find that I find everything you're saying fascinating, and translation, it opens up some very interesting questions about the calculus of the poetry.
If you want, I can elaborate a little bit on what I just said a moment ago.
Please.
The business of the music of ideas. Remember, that was what my friend and colleague and scholar, fellow translator used. That was his phrase.
Yes.
And like I said, I recognize the truth of it when he said it. But let's just say I proved it upon my pulses when I sat down and actually read his translation, and it showed me that, of course, there's room for multiple approaches to translation. In fact, right now in the book I am currently translating, as I mentioned, Faust, a verse drama, right? Well, much. Though not all. Now, let me say, I'd be hard put to put a percentage on it, but let's just say many of the passages, many of the individual poems are in rhyme and meter. But then again, many of them are not. Many of the monologues and many of the dialogues are not in rhyme and meter. Anyway, or rather, they'd be in meter, but not in rhyme. All right. So when I first sat down to translate this, I thought, well, I'll just do what I've long done. I'll translate the rhymed and metered verses into rhyme and metered English, and then the strictly metered but unrhymed verses into strictly metered but unrhymed English. And I very quickly discovered that one, much of it is untranslatable into rhymed and metered English, or even metered English, given the nature of the poetry. Given the shortness of the verses, or given really the diction, which is heavily abstract, philosophical, and indeed repetitive. So there's no room to sort of massage the image into rhyme and meter. And so I thought, very well, those passages that do lend themselves to rhymed and metered or just metered translation, I will do. Those passages, for very good reasons, do not lend themselves to it without gross distortion. I will not. And so I find myself translating great, large parts of it into, well, to use again my friend's phrase, the music of ideas, free verse. In other words, it's that the constraints on translation are really imposed by the original. I know that this book I am translating differs vastly from Poetry Minimal Anthology, differs vastly from Message. My interpretation of it is such that it calls largely for free verse translation. I do not find that the rhyme and meter of the original does as much of the load-bearing work as it did in his other works of poetry, except in those few passages where they do, in which case I do use rhyme and meter. So, in other words, the translator must always take his cue, must take his lead from the original. He should not bring to the text his own preconceived notions of how to translate. The original teaches you which strategy to adopt, which tactics to employ.
And so now I want to talk a little bit about, and it sounds like you have some expertise in this domain. Pessoa is known as Portugal's most famous modernist poet. At least that's the way I have often heard him referred to. And the modernist movement in the arts, in poetry, in the arts, was a revolutionary movement. It was a transformative movement. It took classical structures of art and poetry and writing, and it made something different of them. And I would love for you to speak a little bit about Pessoa, as a transformative modernist poet.
Certainly. Yes, he is indeed the major modernist in Portugal. Indeed, he is one of the greatest modernists in the world altogether. He's in the same league as, say, Ezra Pound and W.B. Yeats and T.S. Eliot. He's one of the 20th century's greats, and he's widely acknowledged as such by by scholars and by the general public. So he's a monument. And yes, we call him a modernist, although modernism has a different meaning in, for example, Spanish literature. And in Portugal, the term modernist was not as widespread as in, let's say, the Anglosphere, right? English-speaking countries. But he was a modernist in that you wanted to speak about his transformation, right? He very deliberately, very systematically, and very very explicitly in his theories that he wrote, in his prose work, in his critical work, in his manifestos, he very expressly set about synthesizing all the best elements of the movements that had preceded the modernist movement of which he was a part. So, the reigning movement of late 19th and early 20th century Portuguese literature was, say, symbolism. Also, decadentism, which is a sort of outgrowth of symbolism and late romanticism. So he was working with multiple literary movements and traditions that were leading up to when he began writing in the early 20th century. And in some of his poetry, he's very symbolist. Others, he's very decadentist. But altogether, his entire, and then in others, of course, he evolves his own strains of poetry with aesthetic theories to back it up. He's responsible, in fact, for creating five isms. We hesitate to call it avant-garde movements, which has a different valence, but his five isms, or let us say schools of poetry, are swampism, Bauismo in Portuguese, sensationism, Atlanticism, and various other isms, all of which globally we may label sensationism. And sensationism set about to draw the best elements out of neoclassical poetry, romantic poetry, symbolist poetry. He very explicitly in his theoretical works said, "We will be universal, we will be synthetic, and we will be cosmopolitan." These are his three buzzwords. In other words, why should Portugal limit itself? Why should Portuguese poets limit themselves to just, let's say, the Portuguese heritage? Now, let's be cosmopolitan and draw the best elements from the other literatures of Europe. And synthetic and universal means let us embrace all of poetry and let us bring together, synthesize out of it, all the best elements from the entire world of poetry. And what's fascinating to me is because he comes from what might be called a semi-peripheral country, that's a scholarly term with a whole history behind it. Portugal was not exactly the capital of European literature, all right? Paris was, London was, later New York was. And so operating somewhat from the margins, he very strategically decided, I will lay claim to the whole of literature, or at least of European literatures, and not just the modern literatures, but the history of the historical literatures of Europe. So he wanted it all. And indeed, in his work, it's so multifarious, not only in terms of genres, but in terms of influences. One work differs vastly from another. All this is part of his all-embracing sensationalist approach to literature. And again, the three buzzwords: synthetic approach, universal approach, and cosmopolitan approach.
So let's get into something which is perhaps the quality that Pessoa is best known for, which is that he wrote in heteronyms. And you can't really talk about Pessoa without mentioning his heteronyms. So heteronyms are synonyms, except the synonym is one writer writing under different assumed names. A heteronym is an entire personality that writes through the author. And in Pessoa's case, he had, seems over his lifetime, written under over 100, over at least 100 of those. Think in Richard Zenith's biography, he talks about 170 heteronyms. And four of these, which are all included, or in your anthology, you include poems by Pessoa himself, which he wrote in his own name, but also as Alberto Cairo, Ricardo Reis, and Alvaro de Campos, who are his three most famous heteronyms. And I once heard this wonderful statement in which it said that Fernando Pessoa, though, and his three leading heteronyms were all in their own right world-class poets, writing in very different styles. Not just styles of writing, but even, Pessoa talks about how when he wrote as Fernando Pessoa, it was a very labored process that took a long time. But when he wrote as Alberto Cairo, he wrote in a very spontaneous form and seemingly unencumbered by the self-doubt that seemed to riddle his writing process as Fernando Pessoa. So I'd love to hear you speak a little bit about Pessoa's heteronyms. It's a unique phenomena in writing. I don't know of anyone else who's had ever done or has ever done since anything quite like it. The heteronyms not only write their own works, but they respond to each other's works. They have relationships. Alberto Cairo was the teacher of Fernando Pessoa and Álvaro de Campos and Ricardo Reis. I mean, I find that utterly fascinating.
Certainly. First, to clear up some details about our book, you were the publisher who, of course, so generously published the American edition of Poetry Minimal Anthology under your very own Emergence Press, which is based on the original Lisbon edition, which I published a few years before, published by Tinta da China in Portugal. Now, this edition contains poems by Pessoa in his own person, and he had a term for that, orthonym, right? And it contains poems by his three major heteronyms, as you mentioned, Alberto Caeiro, Ricardo Reis, and Álvaro de Campos. At the same time, though, I want to highlight another sort of attraction of the book. It has a section at the end of the book under the rubric Others, because as you mentioned, he had over 100 pseudonyms. So, our book, for your listeners who may be interested in getting a copy, also includes poems by such pseudonyms as Dr. Pancrazio, Charles Robert Anand, Alexander Search, Joaquim Moda Costa, Vicente Guedes, and let's see, Denise da Silva. I think I just rattled off six or seven other pseudonyms. And it also includes poems in English, as you mentioned, six poems. But it also, just to highlight another attraction, includes two poems in French, or originally in French, which I translated from the French. And that's what makes our anthology unique. It's unique because it's the first anthology that embraces poems by more than just Pessoa orthonym and his three major heteronyms. It's also unique because it includes poems that were originally written in French. And then, of course, as you highlighted earlier, it's unique because it includes facsimiles or reproductions of the original manuscripts and typescripts. Now, this may be of interest to you and to your readers. In Prose Minimal Anthology, which I published maybe 3 years ago under Tinta da China Press in Lisbon, that's the companion piece to Poetry Minimal Anthology, yes. And in Prose Minimal Anthology, I've got it right here. There is an essay that he includes, that Geronimo, the editor, includes, an essay by Pessoa called The Stages of Lyric Poetry. It's a brief piece, but in this piece, he outlines five stages of lyric poetry that are progressively depersonalized. So, the first stage of lyric poetry, as we all know, is poetry in which the poet expresses his very own thoughts, his very own feelings. Continuing on down to the fifth stage. In the fifth stage, I can read out for you two sentences from my translation. Let us suppose, however, that the poet, while yet avoiding dramatic poetry, formally considered, advances a step further on the scale of depersonalization. Certain spiritual states, thought and not felt, felt imaginatively and therefore lived out, will tend to shape for him a fictional person who feels those states sincerely. That's one way of defining a heteronym, a fictional person who feels those states sincerely, states that were felt imaginatively by Pessoa and lived out imaginatively by Pessoa. So this scale of depersonalization, which is a very unique contribution to modernist literary theory on the part of Fernando Pessoa, by the way. This theory of depersonalized poetry actually has its origins in Pessoa's own life. There is another essay, or rather, I'm sorry, very famous letter included in this prose minimal anthology, which I translated and which I'm looking for right now, so I can just point it out to you. It's a letter to Adolfo Casais Monteiro. It's a fragment that Geronimo, the editor, included in his prose anthology, which I translated. And in this famous letter, Pessoa explains what he calls the psychiatric part of the genesis of his heteronyms. He speaks of his being hysteric, and then he proceeds to what he calls the straight history of my heteronyms. And if you want, I can read out just a very brief paragraph from my translation of this very famous letter. He writes, "Ever since I was a child, I have tended to create around me a fictional world, to surround myself with friends and acquaintances who never existed." Skipping down, "Ever since I've known myself as me, I can remember envisioning the figure, movements, character, and history of various unreal personages." Skipping down. "Thus, I recall what seems to me to have been my first heteronym, or rather my first non-existent acquaintance, a certain Chevalier de Pas, from when I was 6 years old, in whose name I wrote letters to myself." So his heteronymic enterprise originates in childhood. He created his first heteronym, wrote in the person of this fictional character, the Chevalier de Pas, right? Like a French nobleman at age six. What's interesting about Pessoa is he is not the only modernist to embrace an impersonal poetics. Impersonal theories of poetry were common among the modernists. T.S. Eliot very famously wrote Tradition and the Individual Talent, in which he lays out his own theory of impersonal poetry. Ezra Pound was known for the same. W.B. Yeats, known for the same. Borges, the great Argentine writer, known for the same. And so Pessoa was in good company with his impersonal poetics, but I think that Pessoa, unlike the others, first theorized it far more extensively, two, practiced it far more intensely. Remember the five stages of lyric poetry? Well, all of his work, other than Pessoa Orthonym's work, the work in his own person, all of his literature attains that fifth stage of depersonalized work. In fact, one great scholar of Portuguese literature, Irene Ramalho Santos, published a book a few years ago in which she argues that the entire Book of Disquiet is Pessoa's theory of the heteronyms that he practices, well, not only in that book itself, ostensibly written by his heteronym or what he calls semi-heteronym, Bernardo Soares, but all of his heteronymic poetry besides. So it's really his entire enterprise. In that respect, he differs from his fellow modernists, who, it should be stated, also embraced variations of this theory.
Can you give us a succinct definition of impersonal poetry or the theory of impersonal poetry?
All right. First, let me begin with Eliot in Tradition and the Individual Talent. He believed the paradox, he argues for the paradox, that the poet is never more personal than when he is impersonal. He's never more original than when he operates from within tradition. Of course, his bête noire, whom he's arguing against, would be someone like the Italian futurist F.T. Marinetti, who argued for burning the museums and the libraries. In other words, he is very much anti-tradition. Eliot was very much pro-tradition, and he paradoxically reconciled his embrace of tradition, literary tradition, with individual poetry. The individual poet is never more than individual than when he is traditional, never more personal than when he is impersonal. All right. Now, Pessoa, the most succinct statement of his impersonal poetics is none other than the piece that I referenced earlier, The Stages of Lyric Poetry. It's only about a page, page and a half, which I translate in prose, minimal anthology. And his idea is that if you're writing lyric poetry in the first stage, you are just limited to your own thoughts and feelings. Whereas if you progressively depersonalize yourself, then you come to be able to experience thoughts and feelings, or as he calls it, spiritual states that are not biographical or those of your own person, but spiritual states, let us say, available to all humanity. You can, in a sense, become everyone if you have that powerful enough imagination. You're not writing from the point of view of someone else. You're actually experiencing this alternate mindset, this alternate spiritual state. It is, for all intents and purposes, lived out within yourself, so powerful is your imagination. And if you can so wholly give yourself over to these alternate spiritual states, what he says is that will naturally tend to shape a fictional person. The fictional person will grow out of this deeply felt spiritual state within the poet himself. And that's again where he differs from Eliot. Eliot embraced impersonal poetry. He theorized about it extensively. He practiced it most famously in his poetic monument, The Wasteland, from 1922, that famous modernist long poem. But unlike Pound and Borges and Yeats and Eliot, Pessoa took it to the fifth stage, you see? Whereas the other poets may have been stuck in, let's say, stage three or stage four, he, on the scale of depersonalization, took it on to what he labels the fifth stage. And when you are so depersonalized, you can adopt the personality of another, and that personality of another will naturally shape itself into a whole other person. So now you have the other person's physiognomy and biography, even his horoscope. So that's the genesis of the heteronyms.
This is wonderful because this is what I find so fascinating about Pessoa. And in a sense, Pessoa's extreme depersonalization, which reminds me of the Anais Nin quote that says, if you go deeply enough into the impersonal, you find a sort of a deeper personal. There's something about Pessoa's commitment to stepping inside of other personalities, allowing those personalities to form themselves in his psyche, that sort of makes him not just modernist, but really, in some ways, poking into postmodernism. exploring some themes of that really, I think, have become postmodernist themes.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, I actually used to teach. I was officially the professor of modernism and postmodernism at American University Beirut when I was teaching there. From 2006 to 2013, and so I regularly taught a class called Modernism Postmodernism. As it happens these days, and I don't want to bog you down too much into the weeds and the minutiae of the scholarly field, but we speak less of postmodernism, that sort of theoretical concept, developed and promoted by scholars, is sort of on the wane, and so we use that term postmodernism a lot less. It sort of had its moment for about 20 years. But these days, we would really just say sort of contemporary literature, and then if you want to specify, let's say what bundle of themes or techniques a group of writers is employing, then you would find other terms for it. But I think your larger point is, correct me if I'm wrong, Jeff, that Pessoa was such a great writer and so impersonal, that he is not just a monument of modernism, which is really a movement in the arts, not just in literature, right, but also in painting and architecture and in dance and in music. Think of Stravinsky, right? That lasted from very, very, very roughly, let's say, 1890 to 1930. But indeed, Pessoa is a giant of 20th century literature as a whole, and indeed literature as a whole. And he is just as relevant today as he was in the early 20th century. In fact, he is experiencing a boom not just in the scholarly world, but also among general audiences. You mentioned Richard Zenith. He just published a blockbuster biography, what, about 700 pages, something like that. Yeah, quite long, about what, 3 years ago. There are more and more translations of Pessoa, and I like to think that I had a hand in that. But he's also attracting more and more scholarship. As you know, I'm on the editorial board of Pessoa Plural, which is a journal, international journal devoted to studies of Fernando Pessoa, of which Jerónimo Pizarro is the general editor, and I've contributed a number of scholarly articles to this journal. And I remember when I first started publishing with this journal, maybe about 10 years ago, I knew the entire coterie of contributors, but with every issue that comes out, there are new names, scholars that I don't even know, and so the community of Pessoa scholars is ever expanding. In fact, the Modern Language Association just came out with a book of, let's say, pedagogical scholarship called Approaches to Teaching Fernando Pessoa. In fact, I contributed an article to it. So if the United States's major literary association, of which every scholar of literature, professor of literature is a member, if they publish in their publishing series a book on approaches to teaching, it speaks to how Pessoa is increasingly being taught in American classrooms. And so his star continues to rise, which is funny because in this world, stars rise and stars fall. But he's been in the ascendancy for decades now, and it's not going to let up. There's really a publishing boom. And hey, you're part of that. With
Right, that is
Emergence
right.
Press and with Poetry Minimal Anthology. But once again, if anybody really wants the most succinct explanation of his heteronyms, again, I would point you to The stage is lyric poetry, which I translated and forms part of poetry, sorry, prose minimal anthology, a book I translated and published with Tinta da China in Lisbon.
So I think one more little thread of questioning here. You mentioned sensationism earlier, which my understanding is that sensationism is the movement, the literary movement that Pessoa is most closely associated with, and that the great teacher of sensationism was his heteronym, Alberto Cairo. And Alberto Cairo was the mentor or teacher of Fernando Pessoa himself, and also Ricardo Reis, and also Álvaro de Campos. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about sensationism and Alberto Cairo and his role as the teacher of some of the other heteronyms of Pessoa.
Certainly. As I mentioned earlier, Pessoa wrote a number of prose pieces, and you may also call them manifestos, explaining the fundamentals of sensationism, an ism, let us call it, one of five that he himself created. He was really a one-man movement and spawn or generator of other movements. In fact, one of his prose pieces or manifestos is entitled "The Fundamentals of Sensationism." And well, I can read a brief passage. Sensationism differs from all literary attitudes in being open and not restricted. Whereas all literary schools begin with a certain number of principles, rest on determinate bases, sensationism rests on no base whatsoever. Every literary or artistic school contends that art should be a determinate thing. Sensationism contends that art should not be a determinate thing. And he speaks of his basic rules of art: one, all art is creation. Two, all art is the expression of a given psychic phenomenon. And three, for the artist, art has no social end. It's difficult to summarize sensationism because he's laid out the fundamentals in so many manifestos. It's really a bit of a grab bag, but I think from the passage I just read, it resonates. When he speaks about sensationism, not wishing to restrict it, but it's being open, that resonates with what I earlier said about how it's universal, synthetic, and cosmopolitan, and embracing the best, or in his opinion, the best of all forms of literature from neoclassical, romantic, etc. Now, as for Alberto Caedo, he is indeed the mentor to the other three, well, to the other two heteronyms and Pessoa proper, which is kind of interesting. So Pessoa proper depersonalizes himself into in shapes a fictional personage known as Alberto Caedo, who writes in a different way and with a different philosophy from Pessoa proper. But then this heteronym has such a powerful influence on Pessoa proper that now Pessoa proper writes differently as a result of the contact. And the same can be said of Ricardo Reis and of Álvaro de Campos. Now, Alberto Caedo, what he is most known for is what he calls, well, objectivity. He is an objective poet. I don't know if he used that term, but that's the term that we most readily associate with him. By which he means, or by which scholars mean, that sensations, to bring in that word, should be shorn of associations in the way he practices it, all right? The way he practices. I don't want to offer a global definition of sensationism. I told you it's too multifarious to offer you a capsule definition at the moment. But he speaks very clearly in his poetry, especially in his book, or it's been published as a book, The Keeper of Flocks, of his experience of nature is divorced from, divested of associations from the history of literature, associations from symbolism. It's non-symbolic poetry. It's objective because he eliminates, or he claims to eliminate, the subjective dimension of poetry. It's objective. It's depersonalized in a different sense. It's not an expression of his thoughts and feelings about nature, but an expression of his sensations of nature, as if he were seeing nature for the first time. It's about experiencing nature virginally, divested of, philosophy and mythology and history and literature and religion and symbolism. So, in fact, much of The Keeper of Flocks is dedicated to his talking, waxing poetic about how he experiences nature in an objective, non-subjective way. In a way that he claims eliminates all preconceptions so that he experiences sort of naked contact with nature. In this respect, he's very reminiscent of Whitman, by the way. In fact, the most famous, well, one of the most famous verses from Gaedu is, this is in, if anyone wanted to write my biography, one of his poems. He writes, "I was the only poet of nature, the only poet of nature." And then, of course, this also leads into a discussion of Ricardo Reis's neo-paganism, but I don't want to get too much into the weeds. But it's Caeiro is a completely different poet altogether. He's a world worth exploring, and in the anthology that we put out, Jeff, there's a number of his poems. It's about two-thirds rhymed and metered poetry, one-third free verse, and Alberto Caeiro wrote strictly in free verse in long lines reminiscent of Walt Whitman. Well, not too long his lines actually, but definitely he was inspired by Whitman in more than one way.
Beautiful. So, last question for you. In this anthology, Poetry Minimal, do you have a favorite poem in here?
Let's see, let's see. I might have a favorite poem. Let's see. Ansoir Alima. Ansoir Alima on page 149, I believe. That means an evening in Lima, Peru. It's based on an actual song referenced in the book. Let me just turn to it because I have the PDF on my screen right here. One reason why it's my favorite poem, Ansoir Alima, is because my father, and I'm glad I finally got around to mentioning my father. I wanted to at the outset of my interview, of this interview, because Robert N. Schwartz, my deceased father, he died some 5 years ago on April 15th, so 4 days ago would have been the anniversary of his death. He is my co-translator. He is the co-translator of Poetry Minimal Anthology. So to him goes as much credit as goes to me. And in fact, my father, shortly before he passed away, was interviewed by a scholar for publication of the interview with Robert N. Schwartz in Pessoa Plural, that scholarly journal I mentioned earlier. And in that book, I'm sorry, in that interview, which is published and you can find it online, I believe he mentions that his two favorite poems are Ansoir Alima by Álvaro de Campos. No, sorry, by Pessoa Orthonim, Ansoir Alima, and Maritime Ode by Álvaro de Campos. So just because I just now recalled my father, I would have to second him on Answara Lima being among my favorite poems in the book, just because I remember, if for no other reason that I remember so vividly our co-translation of it. It was a real joy translating the book with him, but especially this poem. I have many, many vivid memories of it.
I would love to hear you
All
read
right.
some passages.
All right. Again, Answara Lima, the title of the poem is taken from a song playing on the radio in the speaker, Pessoa. He's hearing on the radio, and it triggers memories of his childhood. Childhood, mind you, that he passed in Durban, South Africa, was today known as South Africa because he spent the better part of his childhood in South Africa. So it's memories of his mother and his childhood, etc. But okay, here it is. So he begins as an adult, right, before he segues into memories touched off by the song. And one other thing, it's in a very, it's in rhymed and metered, but it's very loose, both in the original and in the translation. All right, rhymed and metered, but variable rhyme and meter, let us say. To begin, over the radio comes a voice, drawn out in suave announcer's style. Up next, Answara Lima. I cease to smile, my heart grows vexed. Suddenly, that melody, loved yet cursed, rings out from the still machine. A memory loosened, burst. My soul strays off to a scene. The African moon cast forth its glow on tree-swept hillsides just below. Our living room was cool and large, and placed where all, even the sea, did bask in moonlight dark and clear, yet at the window, only me. My mother at the old piano would play precisely this, Answara Lima. My God, how distant, how lost it all is. What now remains of her elegant style, her voice so cherished and dear, her soft maternal smile? All that remains to remind me is this that I hear, Answara Lima. Still from the radio, richly it soars, that melody coursing through memory stores. The same, Answara Lima. Beautiful was her silver hair beneath the light, and I who never thought she'd die and leave me bound to who I am. She died, but I am still her child, for mothers none becomes a man.
Beautiful. So, John, I'm going to go. I have another call at 11. Thank you so much, my friend, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Pleasure, Jeff.